Right before we talked to our guest today, I did what is known in this business as a good tweet. It got more than 1,000 likes, and yes, that is a humble brag. But seriously, that kind of positive reinforcement matters. It made me feel good for the rest of the day. Who knows why? Especially because I'd already posted yesterday's episode of this podcast on a topic I feel is really important to my personal Facebook page and got nothing. Zip. Like, why did we even make this podcast? And to be clear, I am a grown man. You are probably grown also. This stuff should not matter to us. Or at the very least, it should not have the power to alter our moods at work and at home. And I would like to tell you that it doesn't, but I would be lying and you would know it. And since it does impact many of our moods, again, theoretically, we're talking about stable adults here. What does it do to more impressionable people? People who struggle with mental illness already? Or even just kids, normal kids, who are learning how to navigate the world? Nothing good, and I am not making that up myself. We have all sorts of studies. New ones land almost every day that say teens experience more anxiety, depression, and insecurity than previous generations, thanks in part to social media. So if we know there's a problem, how do we figure out how bad it is? What can we do about it ourselves? And has it now gotten so self-evident that even companies who make millions of dollars keeping us coming back for more realize that they have to find a way to change what their product does to us? I'm Jordan Heath Rawlings, and this is The Big Story. Bailey Parnell is the founder and CEO of Skills Camp, which teaches soft social skills. More importantly, she does a lot of research into social media, mental health, and how to practice safe social. Hi, Bailey.
Hi.
Can you explain the kind of research that you do into social media and how it affects people?
I started my research into safe social when I was working at Ryerson University full-time, funny enough. It was actually professional research at first, not academic. And that professional research, we were working on digital well-being campaigns, and we were working with over like 40,000 students at Ryerson, asking them questions like, what do you like most and least about each of the networks? We would ask them things about time spent on it, how that was relating to well-being within the institution of the school. And we were finding similar things about, you know, what they like most and least about Instagram, for example, what they like most, inspiration, what they like least, comparison. This is what would come up.
Right.
So that research and the TED Talk led me to the academic research. Well, if I'm going to do this anyways, may as well get a degree out of it, was kind of the motivation. Mm-hmm. And in my master's, what I'm doing more specifically, a little bit more fine-tuned, is hyper-focused on comparison and envy on Instagram particularly, and hyper-focused on particularly 18 to 25-year-olds right now.
What is phantom vibration syndrome?
So phantom vibration syndrome is when you think that your phone has gone off and you might even perhaps feel a vibrate, mm-hmm. but when you check, nothing's actually happened. And what's happened is that over the years of mobile technology, vibrate, notifications, we've essentially been conditioned now even to see something like an itch as a vibration from our phone. And so the phantom part is that it hasn't actually happened, where you still might perceive it quite literally as happening, which is kind of weird, eh?
That sounds deeply troubling, actually.
Very strange.
But I know the feeling.
Yeah. Oh, definitely. Even sometimes I feel like I'm hearing something and I go check and nothing's happening, and it's getting more dramatic.
So now that it's been around for well over a decade, what do we know about what social media does to our brains aside from that creepy stuff?
Social media does a lot of things to our brains, both psychologically and now physically. So we have sort of the physiological release of certain chemicals that are tied up with things like notifications, likes, shares, dopamine releases, that sort of thing. But now even more, maybe even more concerning, is that physical addiction, that physical use, the physical practice of picking up the phone, even if you haven't consciously done it. Right now, by every measure, social media is a risky behavior like sex or drugs or alcohol.
Really?
Yes, definitely. We judge a risky behavior pretty simply as when you participate in something, you expose yourself to potential harm. That's it. And we know for sure now, after this decade, that you expose yourself to potential harm on social media. That harm there is things like stress, anxiety, depression, lost productivity, harassment, addiction. Right. So it can go on and on and on. And the truth is that if you actually start viewing it as the risky behavior it is, the treatment is quite similar to other risky behaviors as well.
Are there guidelines for how we know when we're crossing into risky behavior? You know, like how you're supposed to have X many drinks a week and that's the safe number. Is there anything like that for social?
Well, that's a wonderful question, because a lot of my work deals with, okay, if abstinence is not an option, it's not going anywhere, I think we would all agree on that, then how do we practice safe social?
Right.
And that is kind of where I've moved my work towards since the TED Talk a couple years ago, which was more about what's happening out there. How do we know when we've had too much is a great question, which is kind of like, how do you know you've had too much liquor? When maybe it's controlling your life, when maybe it's more important than decisions that actually impact your daily relationships, when maybe you don't even know how you opened Instagram, but you're there half an hour later and don't remember anything you've looked at. Mm-hmm. And my step two in four steps towards safe social is actually moderating consumption. And when you moderate consumption of this risky behavior, social media, you start to ask yourself questions that you would ask yourself with things like alcohol. Am I doing this because I like it, or just because everybody else around me is doing it?
Right.
Was I peer pressured into it? Is this affecting my offline relationships? You start to ask yourself similar questions, and that's when you would, and if you don't like the answers to those questions, then that's when you know you have a problem.
Do we have any data or even indicators of who is the most impacted by this and how badly are they impacted?
Well, right now, I would have to say that I feel most empathy for teenagers, particularly because you have to understand they're already at a phase of life where you go outside the house to compare yourself as a means of socialization. This is not new. This has been happening as long as people have existed. It's in the teenage age range of social psychological development that you leave the family to compare yourself, peer-to-peer comparison. Mm-hmm. And so now you can imagine this is already happening. Now we have this thing called social media that's directly tied to your identity. And now you can do that comparison all the time. It doesn't turn off. It's directly tied to you. And you're comparing yourself to the most successful people, not just the people in your classroom, the richest people, whatever it might be. And at the same time, you have, again, what I called that risky behavior. We have this very particular time of history right now, which won't be this way forever. We have this time of history where you have these kids going through what is essentially mass addiction, also by every measure, though it sounds a little bit dramatic because we're used to that with other risky behaviors.
Yeah.
Certainly mass addiction, same physiological releases, same physical habits. And where can they turn to? Because at this particular time in history, you have parents and educators that largely did not grow up with social media.
Right.
So when their kid is upset that, you know, I don't know, someone didn't respond to their DM, their direct message, they're thinking things like, why does that matter to you so much? Like, it actually doesn't make sense because they've not had to go through
that. There's a whole generation that would just say, oh, that just happened on the internet. That's not real life. Like, don't worry about
it. There's that generation as well. And they're the parents and educators largely right now. Of course, that's a stereotype, but it is generational, because even if you have a 40-year-old right now who's gotten on Instagram and they're the best Instagrammer out there, the truth is it does not matter. They will have never gone through puberty with social media.
Right.
And so they sometimes want to say things like, get your head out of your phone. We'll try to tell an alcoholic to just put the drink down.
Do we have any numbers or research that can quantify exactly how today's generation compares to the previous one in terms of the issues that social media brings on?
In my research, and of course, talking to every kind of person you can imagine now about this, it's something everyone can relate to. The one thing I found is that the trends are not new. They're just amplified right now. So
explain the trends.
So for example, when we say that people are comparing themselves more, the comparing themselves has always happened. And when for me, for example, it was MSN. Like we were on the stuff we would do on MSN, my gosh, we would be on there for hours. We would go to a friend's house and we would just be on MSN the whole night. And the kind of strategies we would play about what song lyrics is in my status. And we would go offline and online to make sure that people knew we were there. This kind of stuff that's happening on social media, all about comparing like display pictures. And then when I told my mom this, she would joke that for them it was the phone. And they would be on the phone for hours talking to each other, especially in that teenage range, and that they would even call people and hang up just so that they knew that they were calling. So this kind of behavior, like that addiction to the friends at that age range, not new. Just what's changed is that these tools, particularly of social media, it's directly tied to your identity. The social currency makes it so that that identity is quantified for everyone to see. The things
what
like
is
the
social
likes.
Currency?
Yeah, so social currency, well, just like a dollar, is quite literally something we use to attribute value to
right.
a good or service offline and online. These likes, the comments, those shares, the actual numbers have become the quantification of the self or that social currency.
Right. We talk about engagement.
Yes, exactly. In marketing, we might call it engagement rates. We might call it advertising money dollars. Like, this is yeah. what they want to know, right? They definitely want to know what your social currency is.
To your point, there used to be the phone, and then there was MSN and ICQ, and then there was Facebook and all the rest of them. And maybe I'm like just old now and we're getting old. How can we make careful decisions around how to use, say, Facebook or Twitter if a year from now, you know, there's going to be Snapchat or TikTok or
yeah.
whatever the next thing is?
Yeah.
What applies to all of that?
I think that you've hit on such a perfect question. Because when I started my research, I actually thought that I would find a more explicit correlation between time spent on social media and the rising levels of anxiety and depression. And I was wrong. What I actually found was no consistency in the research. So I found some people said, yeah, you know, spend a lot of time on Facebook, you're going to have a problem. Some people found no statistical relevancy. That's what they had to report. And some people found the opposite, that time on social media improved the mental health of their participants.
Really?
And so what was always true, though, was that when there was a mediator introduced, or what we call a mediating variable, so this is something like when I compare myself more or when I feel more envy, then it was always a bad situation. And it was actually the comparison and the envy that was the problem, not the time on social media. And so what that suggested was that it's actually not necessarily the networks themselves that are the greatest issue. And like you're saying, those networks can change every day. We can have a new one tomorrow. What was really the greatest issue was who you are offline. And so step three towards practicing safe social is building the offline soft skills. And that's things like self-awareness. Do you even know what stresses you out so that you know when it's in flux? Resilience, so that when anything happens on or offline, you're able to bounce back. Confidence, so that when someone hates on your photo, it just blows off your back, just the same as it would offline. Even time management, because one of the things that frustrated my participants the most was that they found themselves an hour later on social media and didn't even remember what they were looking at. That sort of frustration, and that's why number five is mindfulness. And if you can build this stuff offline, and if there's any parents listening or educators, especially if you can build this stuff before they even enter the networks, then you're going to end up in that category of people where it improves your mental health. And I have to say that I actually was one of those people. Part of my initial curiosity was, why am I having such a good time here when everyone else isn't? And for me, I was getting inspiration, motivation. I was following travel bloggers of, oh, I didn't even know this place existed. Great, I'm adding that to my bucket list. I would connect with family. I would see my nieces that I don't get to see every day, friends that I don't get to see every day. So for me, it actually was a really positive experience. And I think that I would like to think, particularly with the lens of my soft skills training company, that it was because of skills like resilience, self-awareness. I would never find myself an hour later on Instagram, not knowing where the time went. That's just not how it works. And so I think that if there's a new network tomorrow, what will ultimately be true is those built soft skills offline.
Do social media companies acknowledge the effects that you're describing or that you've documented in your research, that it can have an addictive effect on kids especially?
I think social media companies have had no choice but to acknowledge the fact that they have an addictive quality. There's even been some articles that have come out, and I don't know if you've seen them, of employees that used to work at places like
yes.
Google and Facebook, and they just come out and say, to be clear, we design these to be addictive. There are entire jobs in UX or user experience, user design, that are quite literally designed to keep you there. Things like, for example, it's so simple, but your notifications are red because red gets the blood pumping and makes you want to check
really?
It more. Yes, of course. And so even just that little thing is to make you want to check it. The notifications show up red on your iPhone screen because a lot of people do not want that red dot, so much so that they will check every single time that it comes up. Have they acknowledged that this is addictive? Yes, they've had no choice. And I think part of that is due to the most dramatic instances of this addiction, like parents just not knowing what to do anymore. And then I think perhaps the worst stressor on social media is that sort of online harassment, cyberbullying that, again, was happening offline before, particularly in the adolescent age range, but now is just amplified, doesn't turn off, directly tied to you and everything we said.
If they've had to acknowledge this, and this is kind of why we wanted to have this conversation now, mm-hmm. what are they doing about it? Instagram specifically, because they've made headlines.
I think Instagram has made some really great decisions in the last year towards improving mental health. When they instituted Instagram well-being, they now had these web pages for parents, for educators, where I believe it's wellbeing.instagram.com. And it's actually for the parents. It's not even for the kids. It's saying, like, here's the potential risks. That's what I would call it in my profession is potential risks of using this substance, right. essentially. You know, not a substance, but same kind of risks that we would educate parents on if you were to have using cannabis or something like that. They added even things like you get a notification now when you've been on Instagram for a certain amount of time. So if you've set it for an hour, when you've been on Instagram for an hour a day, you will get a notification from Instagram saying, hey, you've been on here for an hour today, and you have to decline it to keep going. So at least that is helping with that frustration I mentioned about people being mad that they've wasted so much time. And the other thing that has come out recently is the removal of the likes on videos and photos and whatnot. And I think that will be a good decision.
How does that work?
So technically what they're doing is they're removing the number, that quantification. They're removing that when you scroll through your feed, you no longer see how many likes someone else's photo has got. From what I understand, you can still see how many yours get, but it removes the comparison, which, like I mentioned, is actually the most damaging part, not the likes themselves. It's the comparing those likes to you. So I actually think it'll be a really, really great move. The only community I saw that was understandably frustrated by this is Instagram influencers and maybe some advertisers.
Sure.
However, I just have to put this out there. I do not think that their concerns for advertising outweigh the concerns of the millions being affected by this negatively right now. You can still see your own likes and you can still see your own engagement rates. Now, the influencers I know in my network, the ones who are actually good business people, they're able to package that and go to advertisers and sell it, just like any marketing, just any sort of marketing. I have this TV channel. Do you want to buy up some ad space? And they know how to say, okay, here's what I can offer you. Here's my engagement rates. Here's my audience. Here's the kind of content I do. I offer video photography services. Here's why you should go with me. Those people, will be okay because they're still going to be able to see their own engagement rates. They can still go package it to influencers.
Yeah.
So I still have to say that I think the needs of the few influencers that might lose some money because the likes aren't public do not outweigh the needs of the many who are being negatively affected by the comparison.
So that's one small step. If Facebook or Instagram or Twitter. Yeah, there's lots more. And if Facebook or Instagram or Twitter or Snapchat or whomever were to reach out to you and put you in the boardroom and say, okay, we want to do something similar. What's the next step? What's the next step we can do to make our platforms less depressing, more inclusive, safer, et cetera?
So when I talk about safe social, often the natural next question is who's responsible for this?
Yeah.
I have to say, like every other risky behavior, it's a multi-pronged approach. So of course, right now we're talking about the institution of the companies themselves. Later we can talk about what government can do, what parents can do, what educators can do, what the self can do. The companies themselves, though, of course, are one of those main institutions. I think, for example, one thing we've never talked about that would be in conjunction with the government is things like age limits. I know that Facebook has, I think you have to be 13 to log on or something. But with alcohol, we've said, you know, 19 is when we think that your social, psychological, and honestly, brain development will not be as harmed by this.
Yeah.
And now what if we gave an age where we said, as a government, I think that at this age in social, psychological development, you are more capable of handling social media without the negative effects. Now, what that age is would be up for debate. But the thing is, sure, okay, I was able to find a beer before I was 19. But I still had a standard for what people in the medical field, people in government, people in child development thought was, by brain development, the age where you will be less affected. And I still had a standard for what was good.
Yeah.
So what you do before that standard, we can't regulate. The companies themselves, let's say, for example, when you first log on or when you first sign up for an account and you have to answer those terms of service, I think that we know now that people do not read the terms of service.
Yep.
Therefore, then that should be understood as not a good way to tell people what this network is about. I think that they have some corporate social responsibility. Maybe it's through a quiz when you first log on. Maybe it's through, you know, did you know this, this, this? And you have to answer yes, yes, yes. Something. I don't know exactly what that is yet. But you have to make sure that people understand the risks of participating before they log on. And the thing is, we do this with other risky behaviors.
Right.
We require alcohol companies to fund MAD campaigns. We require smoking and cigarette companies to put warnings right on the package. We don't allow certain advertisers to advertise on kids' television, yet they can target a 13-year-old on Facebook. This is the kind of regulation that can happen between governments and social media companies. Talk about this forever.
Will it happen?
I think it will happen. I'm starting to see movements towards that. What's happened with this risky behavior is it just came in so fast. It spread so fast in terms of kind of historical timelines mm-hmm. of communication trends. So fast that there has been no regulation at all, because at first it seemed like the benefits were outweighing the cons.
Right.
And to be honest, maybe the benefits still do outweigh the cons, and that's why you don't have mass exodus from these networks, but there still are cons. And for me right now, let's say, for example, the benefits of wine outweigh the cons, but I still have to know what is the risk of partaking.
Unlike other forms of risky behavior, this has also become a tool of mass communication. You know, we wouldn't do the same thing with the phone, for instance.
I mean, some might say that alcohol is a tool of mass communication.
It's a tool of mass something. But like, do you know what I mean? How do we balance the fact that this can be really dangerous for people mm-hmm. with the fact that this is also now, for a lot of people, their lifeline to the world and how they communicate?
Yeah, I understand that completely. And that's what I was saying about these positive benefits of using this tool do, I think, still outweigh the negative benefits, or else there would be a mass exodus. But there isn't. And so one thing you can do for yourself is make sure that you have your feeds to be in line with what actually makes you either happier, smarter, whatever you're trying to get out of it. And also that you have things like privacy security settings up to date. Mm-hmm. You can do things like block certain words from your Instagram comments. So if you're someone who's harassed a lot and maybe, I don't know, the C word, you can block that because there's no instance where you want to see that on any photo. So you can start to do things like this as well. Hopefully that would make it so that you continue to get those benefits without as much of the negative aspects.
Thanks, Bailey.
You're welcome.
Bailey Parnell is the founder and CEO of Skills Camp, as well as a safe social media researcher. That was the Big Story Podcast. If you want more Big Story Podcasts, you can find them at thebigstorypodcast.ca. You can also find us, yes, on social media at TheBigStoryFPN. And now you know a little bit about what a like means to us. Find all our brother and sister shows at frequencypodcastnetwork.com or on your platform of choice at Frequency Pods. As always, we're wherever you get your podcasts. Rate us, review us, tell us what you think. Apple, Google, Stitcher, Spotify, CastBox. Claire Broussard is the lead producer of The Big Story. Ryan Clark and Stephanie Phillips are our associate producers. And Elisa Nielsen is our digital editor. And I'm Jordan Heath Rawlings. Thanks for listening. We'll talk on Monday.
In 2007, TV network CBS dropped 40 kids in the middle of the New Mexico desert as part of a brand new reality show. These kids would have to build their own society from scratch. And if this sounds like Lord of the Flies to you, well, it was meant to.
We were on this mission together. We were going to prove to the world that we could make a better society than adults could.
I'm Josh Gwynn, and I want to know what this wild TV experiment was really about. Split Screen, Kid Nation, a 6-part podcast from CBC. Available now.